Welcome back to the continent's favourite podcast. How are you doing over there in Amsterdam, Dominic?
I'm fine, although it is apparently winter again, and I'm once again questioning why I live in Northern Europe. I'm just back from Italy and missing the weather, the mountains,
oh,
the incredible recycling system they had in South Tyrol.
Really? What was so good about it?
Oh, it was just very strict. They kind of put the fear of God in you that you're going to mess it up, and they put chips in the bags so they can tell that it's coming from your house if you don't separate the recycling properly.
That's amazing.
Which is a bit terrifying, but also means that you do it properly.
I like that. This is a kind of authoritarianism I can get behind.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing is I'm always skeptical with recycling that it's probably being shipped off to the Philippines and burnt in a big heap. But yeah, I shouldn't be so cynical. How is everything in France? Are they still burning the rubbish over there?
This is Tuesday, so more burning is predicted, but we're not really sure what's going to happen later on. I'm actually in London right now and covered in blisters because I went on a woodworking course this weekend.
Why did that give you blisters?
Because I was using some very ancient technology. First, I had to chop the wood with an axe for 2 hours. And then I used a foot-powered lathe and a little scrapey tool. And the bowl is very nice. I'm very proud of it. But the whole thing did also make me quite glad that we have like electric power tools now. The modern world is amazing.
That sounds really fun.
It was very fun. Thank you to my husband for buying it for me as a Christmas present. It was great. But speaking of the modern world, some parts of the modern world are less amazing than power tools, which brings us on to this week's podcast. What are we talking about this week?
Everyone's going to switch off because this is, oh God, another gloomy story. But don't. This week, we're going to be calling up Gabriel Geiger, who's a very interesting investigative journalist who's been working on a pretty enormous international investigation, a fascinating piece of reporting that touches on our government's increasing dependence on machines to make decisions that can have pretty huge consequences on real people's lives. I won't give away too much more yet. Keep listening for that interview because first, of course, it's time to find out who's had a good week in Europe and who's had a bad week.
Good week. Bad week.
Who's had a good week?
Well, I'm giving a good week to the institutions of the European Union after they all agreed provisionally to a new set of rules to reduce the huge greenhouse gas emissions from all those boats in the water carrying our stuff and sometimes us around. It's being hailed as the world's most ambitious path towards maritime decarbonisation and is, with, of course, some caveats, being celebrated by almost all parties involved as a big step forward for the EU's climate change targets, which is quite amazing. I don't think we even need to describe this one as a classic European policy fudge.
Nice. No fudge. Love it.
Well, of course, there was like a bit of fudging because that always happens. But I'm not going to bore you with all the details. I promise I will give you a few highlights of this agreement, if that's okay, Katie.
Go for it. Can't wait.
No need to sound so enthusiastic. This agreement sets limits for the amount of greenhouse gases that ships passing through European ports are allowed to emit. They do that by insisting that ships gradually reduce their intensity of greenhouse gases in their fuel. The first requirement will be a 2% cut by 2025. This then continues to increase gradually until 2050, when ships will have to cut their emissions by 80%. And they will do this in part by switching to more sustainable fuels, which is quite a difficult thing to do at the moment because these so-called sustainable fuels are not really quite ready to be on the market at scale yet. But that is why the first requirement is only a pretty measly sounding 2% cut in greenhouse gas intensity.
Spoiler alert, I am also going to be talking about these so-called sustainable fuels in Bad Week in a second. Which ones are they using for the ships?
Well, there are a few different fuels on the cards at the moment. Green hydrogen, ammonia fuel, and e-methanol. And from what I've read, it seems that methanol is going to be the option that many go for in the short term because the technology is pretty ready. But According to the program manager at the Center for Zero Carbon Shipping, he thinks ammonia will eventually be the winning fuel in 50 years' time. And there's a US startup hoping to launch the first ammonia-powered zero-emission ship later this year. But the EU's deal is not only setting limits of greenhouse gas emissions from ships' fuel, it's also going to incentivize the use of renewable fuels of non-biological origin through a credit system. So that's seen as quite exciting news for the industry. It's quite a different conundrum to the car situation, which I think you might be talking about later, because electrifying the shipping fleet is just not really an option for large ships.
Why can't we have battery-powered boats? It seems perfectly reasonable.
I'll tell you why. It's because, and The Guardian has a really good graphic, which helped me understand why, where they've got this vast cargo ship that normally carries fuel weighing 33 million pounds. And if it was to be made electric, it would need a battery that weighed 1.6 billion pounds, which would sadly make the boat sink.
Oh.
So e-fuels are going to have to be the answer with shipping. And hopefully this legislation will encourage the industry to scale up quick.
What ships does this actually apply to? Is it for like all of the ones that pass through European waters or ports? Like, how does it work?
It's going to be all big ships that pass through European ports, which is pretty cool and gives Europe a chance to lead the world and force companies based outside of Europe also to adapt to our regulations if they want to come through our ports. But it does only apply to ships that are heavier than 5,000 tons. And that is where we have one of these caveats that I mentioned up top. The European Greens are not so happy about that. But it's worth noting that setting the level at 5,000 tons does mean the regulators cover 90% of the emissions from ships. And the question of whether or not to apply it to lighter ships too is going to be reviewed along with much of the legislation in 2028.
Okay, I feel like this isn't the end of the list of gripes. Have you got any more? What else is wrong with this plan?
Not so many more, actually. But I have one more from the European Clean Transport Group, Transport and Environment, who actually really celebrate this. They said that it's the beginning of the end for dirty shipping fuels and the most ambitious package of green shipping laws ever adopted. But they did have one critique. They said there was a risk that the legislation might let biofuels and low carbon fuels in via the back door. And they hope this will be addressed when the law is reviewed in 2028. One other important element of this legislation is that container and passenger ships that dock at ports in Europe will now have to use onshore power or a zero emission alternative while in the port. Nowadays, the power used while docking is often that bad, dirty stuff. So this should help improve air quality around ports as well. And obviously, I'm talking about this in the wake of the pretty terrifying IPCC synthesis report, which came out this month and was essentially a call to pull the emergency brake to reduce emissions across all sectors immediately. We're pretty much out of time. And shipping is a big industry. It accounts for, actually, how much do you think of global emissions comes from shipping? What would be your guess?
Oh, it's a tough one because it's kind of hidden, isn't it? Even though most of us consume things that have been shipped all the time. It feels like cars and aeroplanes are much more visible in our lives as forms of transport. I'm going to guess at 5% of global emissions.
It's actually 3%, which is still pretty bad. And to put that in context, 3% of the world's emissions is about the same amount as the emissions of Europe's largest economy, Germany. And of the global shipping emissions, 18% of those are caused by ships that call at ports in Europe. So this legislation really can make a difference. Aviation actually pumps out a pretty similar amount of greenhouse gas emissions each year to shipping, perhaps even a little less based on some estimations. And I agree that shipping gets quite often overlooked. And despite the shipping industry being such a huge polluter, shipping has often escaped regulation. And famously, it was omitted from the Paris Agreement, along with planes, actually, mainly because their emissions are at sea and aren't so easily attributed to one country or another. So this legislation is an exciting step forward to decarbonize this enormous sector, a sector which our economies rely pretty heavily on, moving our goods around and all. And it comes ahead of a big international summit this summer, the Marine Environment Protection Committee meeting, where there are high hopes for a global agreement on how best to address the maritime sector's huge impact on the climate. So we'll be watching. One final caveat, as we know with all things in Europe, until it's like completely signed off, everything is provisional. This is only a provisional agreement and it needs to be formally adopted by the EU ministers at an upcoming council meeting. But things are looking good. Maybe don't pop your champagne corks yet or smash any champagne bottles against the boat. We'll let you know when you can.
I was going to say, I feel like my bad week that's coming up is quite a good example of things looking like they were going to be fine, and then we're not fine.
Hit me. Who's had a bad week?
It is an energy special of Good Week, Bad Week, because I'm sticking with fuel, but I'm moving off the high seas and taking us to dry land to talk about cars. It has not been the most glorious week for Europe's attempts to fully ban polluting car engines. You might remember back in June last year, the European Parliament voted to ban the sale of new cars with combustion engines by 2035. That was a really big deal because combustion engines, the engines that we find in most cars today, they burn fossil fuels and emit carbon dioxide. So when the EU said it was going to ban them within the next decade and a bit, it felt like something that could massively speed up the transition towards everyone driving fully electric cars and reducing our emissions, especially given that the EU is now legally obliged to become carbon neutral as a bloc by 2050. So no new cars for sale that ran on gasoline and diesel by 2035. That was the idea. Yay. All looked good up until a couple of weeks ago when in walks Germany with an announcement that they were not really behind this ban, at least not in the form it was in. And they were pushing for a loophole that was going to allow some new cars with combustion engines to still be sold after 2035. I should clarify that Germany went into this campaign for a loophole in alliance with a few other countries, Italy, Poland, Bulgaria, and the Czech Republic. But Germany was the loudest voice in this, and it has definitely got the biggest heft in terms of being able to sway EU policy. So it's fair to say that it's Germany that has been getting the most criticism.
And what was this loophole that they wanted?
They decided at the last minute, after 2 years of negotiations over this thing, that they didn't like the idea of all combustion engines still being banned. And they wanted cars with combustion engines to still be allowed if they run on e-fuels. These aforementioned synthetic e-fuels. So in this case, fuels that are made using hydrogen and carbon dioxide that have been sucked out of the atmosphere. And the idea behind them is, yes, burning these e-fuels does still release emissions and pollutants that will continue to heat our planet. But because they're made from gases that have been removed from the atmosphere in the first place, their impact on emissions is kind of theoretically neutral. Critics of these kind of fuels point out that cars using them would still spew out a bunch of carbon dioxide from their tailpipes, so they're not actually neutral. And as you talked about, Dominic, these fuels are not produced on a big scale yet. Right now, there are a lot of experts saying, yes, these fuels do seem to be better than using classic fossil fuels, but if they are really limited in supply, we should be using them for things like shipping, which you talked about, because we can't run planes and boats on batteries, or at least not yet. Mm. For cars, there's already an alternative that's more and more viable. We can replace traditional cars with electric ones.
Germany is obviously a famously car-loving country. Has that got something to do with this desire for the loophole?
It has lots to do with that. So Germany, as we all know, is home to some of the world's biggest car makers, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, Audi, Volkswagen. And the car industry has always been a really powerful lobbying force in Germany. To be fair to the car makers, a lot of them have been shifting their investments towards trying to make good electric cars in recent years. But there are still a lot of companies within the German industry that are really lobbying for the protection of traditional gas-guzzling cars. For example, all of these companies that make the components that go into combustion engines. So they've all been complaining that this plan would destroy the German car industry as we know it and wreak havoc on the German economy. This whole thing also has a lot to do with everyone's favourite topic, German coalition politics. The three parties in Olaf Scholz's coalition, the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the rather neoliberal FDP, they have been arguing horribly in recent weeks among themselves. And this is one of the things that they've been arguing over. The Greens were in favour of a total ban on combustion engines. All of this hoo-ha that Germany has been subjecting the rest of Europe to for the past couple of weeks, a lot of it is down to the fact that the FDP, this neoliberal party, they are struggling in the opinion polls right now, and they have decided to try to chase the votes of drivers, of whom there are lots in Germany. So they're promising to build new roads, and they want to block plans to bring in new speed limits, and they're also promising this e-fuel thing, and saying that they're going to offer lower taxes to drivers who switch to them, and the whole thing is going to be great.
I was quite surprised that the FDP were able to like have so much sway within the coalition government, because they're the smallest party.
They are certainly punching above their weight here.
And they've managed to get their way on this, like, right? The loophole is happening.
Yeah, so Germany managed to thrash out this rather complicated deal with Brussels over the weekend, under which the original legislation is probably going to pass in its existing form. So that allows Brussels to claim victory and say, look at this brilliant law we've passed. But the European Commission have had to commit to figuring out a way that allows new cars with combustion engines to still be sold after 2035 if they run exclusively on e-fuels. Some people are already saying it'll be quite hard to sell cars with combustion engines that can work on e-fuels but wouldn't work with petrol or diesel. But we're kicking that can down the road. We're not worrying about that right now.
Well, that doesn't seem great.
It doesn't, really. It's a real shame, because if this ban was done properly, it would be one of the strongest laws in the world in terms of actually getting the hard thing done, of getting cars that run on petrol and diesel off our roads eventually. And the EU has talked such big talk in recent years about, you know, being a leader on climate policy, that it's been frankly embarrassing that it's had to be watered down like this at the last minute. Other countries have been super frustrated with Germany, especially, and have felt a bit like this one party in Germany's coalition is holding everyone hostage. And it totally dominated the summit over the weekend that was supposed to be about the war in Ukraine and other issues. This also comes at a time in general when European countries are arguing a lot about our supposedly super ambitious climate policy and what should be in it. France is also causing lots of trouble by pushing its nuclear agenda really hard. And in general, neither France nor Germany, the biggest and most powerful countries within the EU, have made themselves super popular over the past few weeks. It's not really a united front, and it doesn't bode well in terms of our general efforts to pull together and save this planet of ours. And it also doesn't look great to have the two biggest and most influential countries in Europe throwing their weight around in quite obvious pursuit of their own specific national interests. Like, it doesn't set a great example. They're often referred to as the engine of Europe, France and Germany. I feel like there's a pun I could make here, but I am going to refrain and simply ask them to do better.
We have a few more people to thank this week for joining us on a website called Patreon. What happens on Patreon, Katie, and why should people join us?
On Patreon, very, very generous people throw us a few bucks every month so that we can pay ourselves and our producers and keep this podcast alive. Is that it?
Yeah. And they get little rewards.
They do.
In return, like personalized voicemails from us, which people seem to like, and access to our secret Facebook Patreon group, which is a fun place to be.
It's the only fun place left on Facebook, frankly.
Absolutely. And we have a few new people to thank this week. They are Helena Neva, Luciana Villar, Vaupe, and Emily for increasing her pledge. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much, everyone. You can head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast to join these incredibly nice and generous people. If you've been listening to this show for a couple of years already, you might remember that back in January 2021, we covered a big, big scandal that had engulfed the Dutch government and forced them to resign. Dominic, can you give us a reminder of what that scandal was about?
Yes, it was called the Toeslagen affair, or the child benefit scandal. And it was a scandal uncovered initially in 2018, showing that the tax authorities had wrongly accused an estimated 26,000 families of making fraudulent benefits claims. And one of the most disturbing things about this scandal, which led to financial ruin for many families, was that one of the criteria used to determine who the Dutch tax authorities would target with these allegations was people with a dual nationality, meaning that almost 70% of the families who were accused were either first or second generation immigrants. This actually eventually brought down the Dutch government, as you may remember, but although it took a while, and Mark Rutte then immediately got back into power at an election, so it was a bit of a convenient standing down. But it was a very big deal, and yeah, I've been reminded of it whilst preparing for this interview.
Yeah, at the time it felt like a really worrying example of how algorithms could ruin people's lives. The algorithms that were used to identify these families and falsely accuse them of stealing benefits, these algorithms had racial profiling essentially baked into them. Fast forward a couple of years, and it seems like authorities around Europe haven't really learned as much as they probably should have done from that scandal in the Netherlands. At least they certainly haven't lost their appetite for using algorithms to try to detect cheating in their local and national welfare systems. These kind of systems are used everywhere, from France and Ireland to Denmark and Serbia. And that might not be such a bad thing if these algorithms weren't riddled with problems. These problems are at the heart of a really ambitious series of investigations by Lighthouse Reports. They're an investigative outlet based in Amsterdam. And along with their partners, they have been digging into just what is wrong with the algorithms that are being used by authorities around Europe to try to detect benefits cheats. We spoke to one of the reporters behind the project, Gabriel Geiger.
I thought it would probably be best if you could start with helping us with some of the basics and help us understand how these algorithms work. What kind of things are the algorithms looking out for when they're searching for potential fraudsters?
So basically what these algorithms do is they take everybody who receives welfare in a city like Rotterdam, in the case of the algorithm we looked at, and assigns them a risk score between 0 and 1, where 1 is the highest risk. And what that algorithm is essentially doing is looking at who committed fraud, welfare fraud in the past, and it tries to find patterns in past fraudulent behavior and then tries to match the profile of the person it's assessing now to those past patterns. If the algorithm was trained to think that more women committed fraud in the past, then it will look at women in now and say, well, they have an increased risk of fraud, so it's going to increase their risk score. That's the basics. I mean, I simplified it a lot, but that's basically how it works.
And that touches on what I wanted to ask you next, because in lots of places, from Denmark to the Netherlands to Serbia, these algorithms have been found to discriminate against certain groups of people, whether it is women or immigrants or Roma people. Can you explain to non-computer experts, why do we keep seeing this happening from algorithm to algorithm?
Yeah, the basic answer to that is that algorithms learn from past data to make new predictions of the present or the future. And in the case of the algorithms we've been looking at, they're trained on flawed historical data. So essentially, if human analog investigators were biased in the past against certain groups, then the data that these algorithms are trained on will also be, you know, contain those same flaws and biases, and the algorithm will learn those flawed biases from that data. And what we've seen in the cases that we've looked at is the deployers of this technology not really being aware that their data contains these biases or taking any steps to mitigate that. So you have what's called a feedback loop, where the algorithm learns a flawed premise from training data and then selects more women or more people with a migration background. And then those people's data is put back into the training data and the algorithm learns that pattern again. So it's like a self-reinforcing loop.
So a lot of your reporting ended up being about Rotterdam. How did you end up focusing on the algorithm in the city of Rotterdam?
basically, as a journalist, it's really difficult to get access to one of these algorithms. And what I mean by access is literally having like the code of the algorithm so you can feed it some data, like, okay, I'm going to feed it the data of a woman who's 30 and doesn't speak Dutch and, you know, show me what the risk score of that woman would be. Having that sort of access is nearly impossible. In fact, it's pretty much never been done before in journalism. But when we started this project, we knew we wanted to try to get that access. And we focused on Rotterdam in the end, not because they were necessarily the worst example of the deployment of this technology, but because eventually, after a year and a half of me kind of poking them, they decided to give me the algorithm. And then my team and I were tested it. There's a little bit more to it than that as well. I think Rotterdam within the Netherlands is an interesting place because it has the largest proportion of people on welfare and has some of the strictest welfare policies as well. So when they investigate people for welfare fraud, it's a particularly kind of harsh treatment of people. So them using this very like advanced opaque technology with this sort of harsh punitive benefits policy made it a really interesting space to investigate how this technology is affecting people's lives.
It seems like what you've uncovered in Rotterdam is different from the so-called Toeslagen affair or child benefit scandal that brought down the Dutch government, but it also has some similarities. Do you think the algorithm could be accused of ethnically profiling citizens for these fraud investigations?
So the Rotterdam algorithm, unlike the Toeslagen affair, the child care benefit scandal, it doesn't directly use someone's nationality as a variable. But what it does use is their spoken language. So it has, you know, 280 different spoken languages that it analyzes. They're each assigned a number. So Arabic to Chinese to Spanish, English, and assigns people different scores based on what language someone speaks. And then also assigns people higher scores if they don't speak Dutch well or don't speak Dutch at all. And experts and as well, you know, different institutions in the Netherlands recognize language as being a proxy variable for ethnicity. So essentially, they're not directly profiling people based on their nationality or ethnic background, but they're using the closest thing to it that they could, which is spoken language. And we saw that, for example, people who didn't speak Dutch well, or, you know, whose spoken language at home was not Dutch, was something else, received higher scores. We conclude in our reporting that, yes, the algorithm did ethnically discriminate against Rotterdammers.
I was really interested to read in your reporting about how when you asked officials from the city of Rotterdam about parts of the algorithm that were to do with language, there was this one variable in it, and more than half of the people were listed as having a zero for this category. But when you asked the city what that meant, they didn't even know. I mean, that seems particularly worrying, doesn't it? That there are things going into these calculations that the humans working on the system don't even understand.
It is. And I think that's one of the themes that we saw across our reporting is often officials themselves don't really understand the systems they're deploying. So you already have this huge problem of the people who are being scored by these algorithms, not knowing they're being scored, not knowing how they're being scored. And that's a huge problem, of course, and a huge sort of violation of their due process, I think. But then you have another layer, which is the officials themselves not understanding how their own systems work and how they could be discriminating against certain people. And, you know, also this applies to caseworkers as well. So one example we use in the piece is essentially if you have this caseworker and they're writing comments about you, the algorithm will read those comments as a variable when it's making its calculations. But it doesn't look at the content of what social workers are writing. It just flattens their response. Did they write something about this person's motivation? Okay, that's a one. And if they didn't write something, that's a zero. Someone could write, he's really motivated, and that'd be a one. And they could also write, he's not motivated at all, and that'd also be a one. And caseworkers have no idea that what they're writing in these fields actually influence people's risk scores. So across the board, there's a kind of a chain of people who have no idea what's going on. And meanwhile, the system is flagging people for investigations that can have life-changing consequences.
Yeah, and you looked into those life-changing consequences. And what did you see? What are the human consequences of being targeted by one of these machine-determined fraud investigations?
Yeah, so one of the profiles we found to be especially high risk to the algorithm was mothers, especially if they were struggling financially and didn't speak Dutch. So we went out on the streets and met some mothers in Rotterdam who had been subject to fraud investigations. In the piece, we explore one woman who had her benefits cut for 1 month with really drastic consequences. I mean, she couldn't buy food. She had to borrow food from her neighbors. She had to take her kid out of school, and he had to get a job to support the family. So people's lives can really be upended by these investigations.
You also looked into Denmark, a country with one of the world's best funded welfare states. What did you discover about the kind of fraud detection systems that they're using over there?
Yeah, it was Denmark's an interesting case because it's kind of considered one of Europe's quintessential welfare states or a model welfare state. And what we found was that over the past 10 years, Denmark had essentially built like a massive algorithmic surveillance machine targeted towards welfare recipients, collecting data from 9 different government databases and analyzing everything from the length of your marriage to how often your kids left the country. The Danes are also using second nationality in their welfare surveillance system, and going even a little bit step further, where they're actually trying to estimate people's connections to particular countries outside of the EU. So they have like these crazy network graphs of like, okay, well, this person looks like they're connected to Sudan, and that seems suspicious to us. So yeah, the level of the data collection and surveillance in Denmark was something that made it really stand out, even in comparison to the Netherlands or some of the other countries we looked at.
I know that the concept of welfare cheats is a favorite topic of right-wing politicians across the continent, well, across the world, and certainly in Denmark. But do we have any idea of how widespread welfare fraud actually is in Europe?
Surprisingly, there's not that many reliable statistics. A lot of the statistics come from consultancies and software developers that stand to gain something from governments adopting these fraud detection algorithms. But we do have some statistics from, example, in France, where the Court of Auditors, so an independent government body, has done some research. And there it was about 0.36% of all benefits paid. There was a study done by RTL in the Netherlands that estimated it was about 0.24% of all benefits paid, and the average fraud per benefit was 17 euros. In Denmark, politicians throw around consultancy estimated figures of 5% of benefits paid being fraudulent, but those types of estimates have been quite criticized by academics. From the more reliable studies I've seen, it's probably less than 1%.
It's pretty clear that authorities around the world are bringing in these systems because they are assuming that they are more effective at spotting fraud than human-run systems. After all this reporting, have you come to a conclusion about whether they actually are, to any extent, more effective or as effective?
So in the case of Rotterdam, the algorithm performed a little bit better than random selection. So not a great advertising slogan. In places like Denmark, we saw that, you know, out of the 50,000 cases that these algorithms flagged, around 8%, there was something wrong. So that means, you know, 92% are wrongly subjected to investigations. You know, it's difficult to compare. There aren't that many great statistics even about how many cases of fraud did humans find based off of anonymous tips, for example. I wasn't able to find statistics on that in the Netherlands, at least. But overall, most of the systems we've seen perform only marginally better than random selection, and then come with all this extra baggage of ethnic discrimination and profiling and people not understanding how the system works. I've yet to see some system that has, okay, like a 70% accuracy rate.
And is there any chance that citizens' privacy rights are actually being curtailed through the extensive use of these algorithms? Is all of this actually legal?
I think a lot of them probably are actually technically legal, yes. Basically, they don't use these sort of special categories of data that are protected under European data protection law. So they kind of skirt around it. With that said, there has been a famous case in the Netherlands called the CD case, where a group of activists took a welfare surveillance algorithm to court and got it banned. And the judge decided it violated Europeans' right to privacy. So it remains to be seen whether these algorithms, you know, if actually tested in court, may be struck down on a sort of legal philosophical violation of people's rights to privacy, that the amount of data that's gathered is disproportionate to what the task they're trying to achieve. But it just hasn't been tested that much yet.
The European Union is hoping to pass a much talked about new law to regulate artificial intelligence. Is there any hope that this forthcoming law could actually make it harder for governments around Europe to discriminate against welfare recipients and people in general using algorithms?
It certainly aims to do that. Of course, it's being debated right now, so we're not really sure what the final text is going to look like. But there's this discussion around high-risk AI, and the algorithms that we looked at in our series would certainly fall under that label of high-risk AI and would be subject to more stringent regulations, you know, things like human rights impact assessments. They would be required to sort of have a registry where all these high-risk AI are put into. I think it's a good step in the right direction of establishing like a baseline of transparency and accountability. But I must admit, I'm a little bit skeptical about how far it will actually go. There's businesses that are like developing these AIs that are lobbying on the EU level to, of course, soften these regulations. So I think when things are all said and done, it will be a step forward. But I'm a little bit skeptical if it will really be a game changer when it comes to holding AI like this accountable.
Gabriel and his team have more reporting coming out on how these algorithms are used in specific countries like Spain and France. So look out for those investigations in the weeks to come. Lighthouse Reports have done a really amazing job in this reporting of explaining really quite complicated issues around algorithms and their impact on human beings in a very accessible way. So we definitely recommend that you check out the various pieces that they have published, which are in Wired magazine and elsewhere. The link is in the show notes.
There were actually a few of you who got in touch to bring this reporting to our attention, so thank you. You can always get in touch with us on Twitter at EuropeansPod or via email hello@europeanspodcast.com with ideas for the show. Thanks.
What have you been enjoying this week?
While I was in Italy, I actually had some time to read a book for fun, which was very nice. I haven't finished it yet because it's enormous, but I'm halfway through Ian McEwan's latest novel called Lessons, and I'm very much enjoying it, especially how very European it all is. It's set so far anyway between Germany and the UK mainly, and I won't give too much away, but some of the characters in the book are connected to the White Rose, which is this famous real-life resistance movement that took place during the Second World War. It was run by some students and a professor based at the University of Munich who were incredibly bravely writing and distributing leaflets in opposition to the Nazi regime at huge risk to themselves between 1942 and 1943. I have to say I shamefully didn't know a huge amount about them, but after reading about them in Ian McEwan's book, I wanted to find out more. So I did some Googling and discovered that the last living member of that group, a doctor called Trauter Lafrenz Page, died just this month at the age of 103. Mm. And I highly recommend you all go and read her obituary in the Smithsonian magazine, which I'll link to in the show notes. Even though she wasn't a central figure in the group, she still did amazingly brave things. And it's both totally inspiring and tragically sad to read about the White Rose's efforts to fight back against the horrors of the Nazi regime.
Wow, I'm definitely going to check that out, and the novel too.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I have been enjoying falling asleep to the audiobook of A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, read by its author, the British geneticist Adam Rutherford. As you can probably guess from the title, it's not a book specifically about Europe. It is an accessible book about the genes of humans, all of us, all over the planet. But there is a lot in there that is specifically of interest to us as Europeans, I think, and people who are interested in Europe. There's loads about the Neanderthals and also things like why Europeans are much less likely to be lactose intolerant than people from most of the rest of the world.
Oh my God, that's so interesting. I went to visit Ötzi this week, you know, that really ancient
man,
the oldest man that was found in the ice.
Yeah.
Near Bolzano. And there was a whole thing about lactose intolerance there too. And did you know that in
much of the Southern Hemisphere, like only 20% of people are lactose tolerant even today.
Yeah, it's loads of places. Most of my Vietnamese side of the family are lactose intolerant, or lots of them anyway.
So interesting that we both found out about that a bit more this week.
Big week for lactose. Another fun fact, you know, Charlemagne, the emperor from back in the day.
Yeah.
You and I are both statistically almost certainly related to him.
Oh, cool.
It's not the reaction I was expecting. But it does explain why we're so regal, I think.
Absolutely.
Anyway, it is a really entertaining book that taught me lots. Adam Rutherford is also, I think, really thoughtful on the concept of race and the extent to which it does or doesn't exist. And he brings a healthy dose of skepticism to those, you know, those genetic tests that you can do that say, congratulations, you're 9% Native American or whatever. It's also a particularly great book to fall asleep to, because every time I wake up, like, something interesting is happening, but I don't feel like I've missed any plot. But I can also recommend reading it while properly, fully awake. It is called A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived.
Sounds great. I've got a happy ending for you from Pompeii, that huge Roman city that was buried under the ash and pumice of a brutal eruption from Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD and then was only rediscovered about 250 years ago. Well, over there on the huge archaeological site, only 2/3 of which have been excavated so far, they have started employing some new helpers to stop the site getting overgrown with plant life, something that could potentially damage the ancient buildings. I said they are employing new helpers, but I don't believe the new helpers are actually being paid, because they are sheep.
Aww.
Yes, the archaeologists of Pompeii are using a flock of 150 sheep to help munch away on the grass and other plants and limit erosion to this incredibly special site.
Pay the sheep. Pay the sheep.
It's very George Orwell of you. It reminds me of Animal Farm. Yeah, maybe they should be paid, but I think they kind of enjoy eating the grass and the plants. At least I hope so. And I don't think it's particularly hard work, but who am I to say? Perhaps we should go and get some vox pops from the sheep.
This is what people say about unpaid internships. You know, like, you should be grateful for the opportunity to be here. Pay the sheep.
Ethical conundrum aside, it's also happy because this solution means that the team at Pompeii don't have to use chemical substances to kill off the unwanted plants. So I'd argue it's much better for the environment and it saves the park money too. The director of the park, Gabriel Zuchtriegel, pointed out to Reuters that when Pompeii was rediscovered over 275 years ago, sheep would have been roaming around this area because it was an area that was made up of woods and vineyards. So if anything, I'm suggesting it's a happy ending because it's like inviting the sheep back into an environment that used to be theirs. I guess you could argue it's kind of rewilding. Thank you, sheep.
Next week, we will be attempting to bring you a little calm by talking about libraries and the wonderful places that they are and the things they can do. Don't miss it. That new episode will be in your feed as ever next Thursday.
In the meantime, check us out on the socials, Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, where Katie's been sharing pictures of that wooden bowl.
My bowl.
Which is actually quite beautiful. Well done.
Thank you.
And you can also email us hello@europeanspodcast.com.
See you next week.
Bye, guys.
Tschüss.